This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. How's North Carolina doing when it comes to clean energy? A new plan from the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality aims to substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade. The agency's goal is to get to zero emissions by 2050. The plan is part of Governor Roy Cooper's executive order last fall that commits North Carolina to comply with the Paris Agreement. Billy Pizer is a professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University and joins me in the studio now. Welcome back, Billy. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I've looked at this thing, but I'd rather have you tell me what's in it and sort of how you see this plan and sort of maybe outline the goals for us.
Sure. Well, Governor Cooper had his executive order about a year ago, kind of gave the broad picture of trying to make substantial reductions in greenhouse gases. Commission this report, this plan, and the plan basically does what lots of plans do. It kind of identifies lots and lots of different things to do over the next few years. I think 50 different recommendations, figures out what sort of time frame to do them over, who's going to actually have to do them. And if you kind of add it all up, the goal is to substantially reduce carbon dioxide emissions, as you said, increase clean energy in North Carolina, do it in a way that's fair and equitable to people, and you know, try to move this forward at a point where we don't have as much action on climate change as we really need.
All right, so it's one thing to set goals, another to set a path for how you get there. So what are the proportions in this report in terms of its recommendations?
Well, I think if you kind of look at all the details, there are some things that are very little and some things that are much bigger. You know, every little bit counts, I suppose. But of course, the really big ticket items are going to require legislation. You don't really fundamentally change the way businesses and individuals behave without incentives that come from legislation. And I think that's kind of where the rubber will meet the road.
So how does that look? What kind of legislation would be required, do you think, to meet these goals?
Well, I think there are two big things that are identified in the plan, basically. One is to expand the state's current renewable energy standard. So that requires something like 10 or 15% of power generated in North Carolina has to come from renewable sources. Expanding that to 20% or 25%, that would be a pretty significant increase. The other big ticket item really is a cap on emissions or some sort of statewide regulation that would really be the basis for businesses to begin seriously thinking about their emission levels.
And so you would have to legislate this.
You'd have to legislate this, exactly. Regulations, rules. You know, regulations always sounds kind of bad to people, but it's really just the rules of the road. So people know how to behave and can make better decisions about the future.
Well, but it sounds expensive to people. That's the problem, isn't it? Because if you say, look, we're going to require that X percent, 25% of your power come from renewables by X year, I got to make a transition. That transition is going to cost money. I'm going to pass that on to my customers. Isn't that our problem?
Well, of course. I mean, I think it's kind of, to me, it's a little bit unfair to say that the environment has to be free in order for us to do something about it. So I think it is going to cost some money to do these kinds of things to get cleaner energy and to reduce carbon emissions. But I don't think it has to be that expensive. I think, you know, based on where we are right now, I think there are a lot of things we could do that would be almost negligible to most residents of the state.
Like what?
Well, even minor increases are more substantial increases in the renewable energy standard, I don't think would raise electricity rates that much. I think the idea of a cap or some sort of bigger piece of legislation on carbon dioxide, you know, maybe would raise rates a few percentage points over the next couple of, you know, next decade. But in contrast to all the other things that are moving electric rates around and affecting people's lives, I think, again, this would be relatively negligible.
What about the other side of that? Because in order to meet those goals, you're going to have to change some of the way you're doing business, which suggests to me that you're going to have to buy something, right? I mean, you may have to change, maybe you take a coal plant out of commission and replace it with a different plant, or you use new technologies. All of that suggests to me some level of economic development. In other words, somebody could make money while I'm spending it.
For sure. I mean, when I think about the costs of regulation, I'm not thinking about the cost of the renewable plant as the whole thing being the cost, because obviously there's a cost, but there would have been a cost of producing the power anyway. Right. And I kind of think it would be better to have the jobs and the economic activity going in a cleaner direction than a dirtier direction. The incremental cost difference between them is not that much. The other, you know, big item to think about is most people think this is the way the world is going. Most countries, most jurisdictions, most people are concerned about climate change and we've got to do something. Beginning that transition now, getting North Carolina ahead, beginning to take these steps before we have to make more drastic action, I think is the way to make sure that we do it in the most friendly, economical, and, you know, the best way for the citizens of North Carolina.
Well, I want to stick with the economics for a minute, and then we'll talk about some of the costs of not addressing this at all down the line, but just the economics of making a transition along the lines in this report with these recommendations. I mean, on the one hand, you have the cost of if you're going to renewables, that suggests, for instance, more solar panels, I guess. So two things come to mind. Somebody has to make these solar panels. Doesn't that represent an economic opportunity, an opportunity for economic development if you can attract that business here to mitigate or somewhat offset the costs of going to this new technology?
Yeah, exactly. I think there are certainly a lot of jobs in the clean energy sector, whether it's manufacturing the equipment, like LED light bulbs that are manufactured here, or solar panels. There's a lot of installation and operational activity and jobs that go along with that. So there's certainly jobs and stuff that go along with that. And I think the real advantage is if this is the way the world is going, and I really think there's a lot of evidence that it is, then North Carolina getting in on it earlier puts them in a much better position.
Well, how so?
Well, because they do have the opportunity to develop these industries. They provide a catalyst for activity. I mean, North Carolina, surprisingly perhaps, I think is second in the country in terms of installed solar capacity, thanks to tax credits they had up until 2015. That has spurred a lot of development, not necessarily in terms of manufacturing the solar cells, but in terms of the installation companies and those sorts of businesses that sprang up to support all of that.
And tell me about the cost of producing renewables, too, because you said, well, if you go to this, we can expect a slight increase in our energy bills, right? Our power bill is going to go up a little if we go to renewables. Is that just a temporary increase? Does the cost ultimately go down because we're using renewables, or will the use of renewables always be more expensive than the use of coal?
Well, I think it's a little bit hard to talk about what's going to be the difference in costs of power generation after 5 or 10 years, because when we begin looking in the future, the costs are going to depend a lot on which path we take. The more solar and renewables that we install, the cheaper they're going to become, and the less we do with fossil, the less technological improvement is going to occur in that industry. So I certainly think over time it's going to be true that renewables are cheaper than fossil. In some cases, they already are. You know, one of the problems you have to deal with renewables is intermittency. So you have to have backup generation or batteries that creates an additional cost. But the cost of those technologies are also coming down.
Right. And again, with research and development, you know, that can come down even further, advances in that industry. If the market was sure that's where you were going, but if you debate whether or not that we need this, then the market says, well, I'm not so sure I want to invest in that technology.
Well, there is a lot of investment taking place in these technologies, even without the regulation. You know, the emissions are down in the United States. They're down in North Carolina. Some of that's owing to policies. Some of that's owing to changes in energy prices. But I think if you look at the seriousness of the problem, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for low-cost emission reductions that we could be doing now.
All right, so you've said a couple of times, look, because this is the way we're going, we need to get on board quicker, sooner rather than later, for a couple of reasons. Let's talk about the cost of not addressing this. Right now, you know, we keep hearing about cheap coal and nobody wants to move into these other technologies. What if we do nothing over the next 50 years?
Well, I mean, the projections. Well, first of all, just to note, I mean, we're already feeling impacts from climate change. You know, cities across the United States are warmer than they've ever been before. We're seeing increased mortality and morbidity as a consequence of these sorts of things. We're seeing more frequent storms. I mean, I have to tell people in North Carolina about that. More flooding. So all these things are real costs, and the projections are simply this is going to, you know, increase even more, you know, in the future over the coming decades. So, you know, what we're really talking about is, you know, a little bit of insurance. Well, not really even insurance. It's like I think you were saying earlier, like a retirement account. Like we know we need to put some money in now, and we're going to have all these benefits later on.
Right. Is that and we talk about the way this is done. It's fascinating to me to see this turmoil over auto emission standards in California, with the auto industry siding with the state of California for stricter emission standards and actually sort of pushing back against the Trump administration. What's going on there, and what does that tell us about what the market would really like when it comes to this policy?
Well, I think most businesses, I mean, they don't want to be jerked around. They don't want to have crazy fast changes in the rules of the road. But they want certainty. They want to know what the rules of the road are going to be. And when you're in a space like we are now, where I think the policies have not really kept up to speed with where the science and where the evidence is about the consequences, businesses are assuming there's going to be something. And they would rather know for sure what it is and feel like it's a policy that's actually durable and is approved by 80% of the population and is not something that's really just a minority supporting it. So in the case of California and the cars, I think they're siding with California because they think California is a better indicator of where we're going to be in 15 years and where the rest of the world is going to be perhaps even sooner.
And you've talked about the fact that even shareholders, because one of the worries is if you wait for the market to respond and give us the kinds of technologies we need that will be sustainable in the future, it might be too late. It might be a crisis. We might be at a crisis point. But you're suggesting that savvy shareholders recognize that we're very near the cliff and they might end up paying for this if they don't start now.
Yes, there's been a whole movement, a disclosure movement, to try to make sure that companies are reporting what they're really two sets of risks. One is what their risks are from climate change. So, you know, you might have insurance companies obviously could have a lot of claims from flooding and storms and things like that if there's climate change. But then you also have companies like coal companies that could be subject to a lot of regulation. Or power companies who have a portfolio of fossil plants that could be subject to regulation, where the shareholders may be concerned that all these assets are going to be affected not by climate change itself, but by the policies to address climate change. And so there's a lot of effort out there right now to get companies to report their liabilities and their risks and their exposure to these types of things. And it goes all the way up to central banks that are concerned about possible macroeconomic shocks if suddenly it becomes so dire that we have to take drastic action and a large segment of the economy or a notable segment of the economy has to be reshuffled, and that's expensive.
This is about as close as it comes to those so-called externalities, right? All of those things that we're experiencing that you enumerated and more that are social costs. And so they're not on the ledger, right, of that corporation. But you're suggesting that corporations are starting to feel, and even federal banks, national banks, are starting to feel the pinch and recognize that what had been externalities may very soon be on their books.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, the fundamental challenge of public policy is to take these things that society values but are hard to, that are not priced in the market, and put a price on them one way or another, usually through regulations, maybe through some sort of other policy. And in anticipation of that, you can imagine all these shareholders saying, look, I know this is coming down the road and there is going to be a consequence for this, and I want to know what that's going to be when it happens.
How does it work best in terms of, because, you know, what you hear as the critique against these kinds of policies is, look, the government's the worst at calling winners. We don't want them interfering with the market and telling us how to run our business. And yet we know we've got this cliff that we're heading toward. We may have already be off the cliff. What's the best way, do you think, for those two, you know, sort of competing ideals to work together?
Well, I mean, the simplest approach that economists always love is to simply put a price on the externality, or in this case, carbon emissions, and say, you know what, carbon emissions, we know that reducing them is going to avoid future economic costs of maybe $40 a ton. So what we should do is make people pay $40 a ton right now. Get the government out of the business of deciding what businesses and individuals have to do, let them face that price and make their own decisions. And that should lead to the right answer. So that's kind of the best answer from a like economic efficiency, but you can get a lot of the way with other types of flexible regulation that still let companies make choices about how best to reduce their emissions, but don't necessarily lead to taxes and government revenue, which, you know, for some, for some stakeholders is something they don't want to see. They don't want to see bigger government, and so they don't like the idea of taxes. So you can get the same outcome with other forms of regulation.
And how does that work?
So the simplest version that I like, there's two versions. One is you cap emissions. You say, okay, we're only going to allow 5 billion tons of emissions in the United States. So we're going to give out a bunch of allowances that allow everybody who has one of those allowances to emit one ton. You let people trade them, and the people who really want them buy them. The people who don't need them sell them. There's no money to the government necessarily. Maybe some of them get sold by the government. Maybe some of them get given away for free. Make those choices. But you ensure that emissions do not go above that cap.
And that way, again, the industries themselves are working out the deals.
The industries themselves, the individuals are working out the deals, and the money's not going to the government.
Roy Cooper is one of 25 governors to sign the U.S. Climate Alliance that commits those states to the goals of the Paris Agreement. What good is that?
I think it's very important symbolically. I mean, one of the challenges you face is that there are a lot of countries there are a lot of people outside the United States who are not as plugged into what's going on here. They see the Trump administration come in and walk away from the Paris Agreement, and they may not understand that this is a very rich country in terms of diversity of opinion. And so all these stakeholders, jurisdictions, states, local governments, businesses, universities, pledging to maintain the commitment of the Paris Agreement sends an important message to everyone that there are people who are really working to do this.
Billy Pizer, professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Thanks, Billy.
Thank you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Wizard of Oz turns 80 this year. Want to know your experience with the Wizard of Oz. When you saw it, was there a moment in the film? What was it like for you? Did you see it over and over again at the holidays? Give us a tweet at #SOTMovie or send us an email at SOT@WNC.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.